Welcome to a new special series at QUB's LawPod. We explore something that we generally take for granted as a trusted source of justice, records. But we wanted to know, can the record be trusted? We, that is me, Dr. Julia Weiberg, a social legal scholar in the School of Social Sciences, Education and Social Work at Queen's University Belfast.
And me, Dr. Ulrike Lühr, a postdoc at the School of Public Policy and Global Affairs and the iSchool at the University of British Columbia.
And me, Dagmar Hovestedt, longtime spokesperson for the Stasi Records Archive in Germany and currently an adjunct professor at the Human Rights Center at the University of Galway. We are three female scholars who are exploring the intersection of archives, transitional justice, and human rights since 2018. Records come into existence in various ways and are managed by a multitude of actors. They're created by institutions as byproducts of their work. They are collected and created by human rights activists and organized. But transitional justice mechanisms themselves also create a range of records. These are also some of the actors we will talk to in this series.
The digital age has produced a whole new generation of documentation, ranging from open source collections of vast amounts of data to eyewitness photos and videos captured on cell phones. And of course, there are dozens of NGOs that have been founded to collect evidence in countries such as Syria, Iraq, Yemen, Sudan, Ukraine, Gaza, and many more.
So what is the role of these records then in past and ongoing human rights violations? Who documents what with what intention? And can these records truly make a difference in future criminal trials or in the long term for memorization processes? And what happens when they are archived? How does artificial intelligence and the digitalization change our relationship to these records? These are some of the questions we want to explore in this series. I'm Julia Weiberg, a social legal scholar in the School of Social Sciences, Education and Social Work at Queen's University, Belfast. In our episode today, I welcome Babacar Ndiaye, who has served as a senior program officer with the United Nations investigation team to promote accountability for crimes committed by Daesh, also known as ISIL, in Iraq. Welcome, Babacar. So could you tell us to start with a little bit about yourself and what motivated you to work with the United Nations?
Thank you very much and good morning, everyone. I've been working for the UN for the past 11 years as an information system specialist. Before that, I spent 14 years in private sector, helping companies implement innovative projects to improve their efficiency, reduce costs, and improve their profitability. I decided to join the UN because I wanted to be part of a more meaningful work and also to be able to give back. Having a background from Africa, coming from Senegal, I always believed that it was important for me to work in companies that are engaged in making this world a better place and in helping people and countries that are going through hardship, through violence, or through crime. So it was very exciting for me to be part of the United Nations team in Baghdad to help the government of Iraq collect, store, and use the evidence that has been gathered to advance accountability for the crimes committed by Daesh in Iraq.
So perhaps before we delve further into Iraq and your work with UNITAD there, could you perhaps more broadly tell us first what you actually do as a senior program officer and what does the UN and archives basically mean?
So that's an excellent question. In everything that we do at the UN, the records take a central place in our work. Everything, every product that is created, that is generated by the United Nations, must be preserved and made accessible for transparency and accountability purpose. So really, record is at the core of our business. As a senior program officer, working initially in New York in the headquarters, my job was to support the different departments and offices in improving the way that they operate, whether it is through the implementation of ERP, Enterprise Resource Planning System, whether it is to bring new tools, such as situational awareness tools, to really help the organization close the gap with private sector and other entities in terms of operational efficiency and our ability to deliver on our mandate.
So what role do digital tools play in that whole archiving works and of the United Nations and basically the role of the record?
Yes. So since the creation of the United Nations, as I said, every single record that has been created is made available through the archive and record management in New York. So when a mission is established, all the different documents and records that are produced up to date are available in a digital format. So we have a retention policy for physical archive, but the digital archives is there forever. In terms of the importance of digital tool, and even a bit more now with the explosion of AI and Gen AI and the ability to search and to harness a huge amount of data, making this information available to such tools, such as ChatGPT as an example, or other USA search tools, is really critical for us because it allows us to really understand all the history of the Union, have access to all the resolutions, all the documentation that has been produced to better inform our decision and actions moving forward.
So, and this knowledge, what you just described around the records and record keeping, basically. So how did you make this work in Iraq and with UNITAD, basically?
Yes. So in Iraq, it was really at the core of our mandate. If you look out about our term of references, our main purpose was to collect, to store, and to analyze all evidence that are related to crimes committed by Daesh that may amount to war crime, crimes against humanity, and genocide. It was really at the heart of our work. So when we arrived in 2018 and we start engaging with the government agencies, we realized the sheer magnitude of data that has been collected. We're talking about dozens of terabytes. Therefore, it was essential for the organization to bring in a team of experts to organize, categorize, and make accessible these millions and millions of documents that are on a digital format, already born digital format, but you can have text files, audio files, video files, images. So a vast corpus of information that has to be consolidated and organized in a way that allow investigators to make swift access to it in advancing the preparation of their case files and their investigations.
So Babacar, you were mentioning that there was a vast amount of data on the ground. So could you perhaps describe a bit more in detail what type of data that was and who collected that data?
That's an excellent question again. Primarily, the data was data that was retrieved from the battlefield. It's, some call them battlefield evidence. When the coalition forces led by the American got rid of ISIS, the security forces on the ground collected servers, cell phones, physical paper documents, drones, computers in the thousands. So every computer having their hard drive was extracted, and this represented dozens and dozens of terabytes of data. Also, ISIS was also a very heavy administration. They had rosters with all their members, with information such as their name, first name, pictures, fingerprints, the role that they were paying, even the amount of salaries or the indemnity for their families. So all that information was retrieved and stored in different formats. As I said, either on paper format, but mostly on digital format, on hard drives and memory stick and external drives.
So you were mentioning, and that just, you know, stood out for me, that you were collecting drones, for example. So how do you go about collecting data from a drone? What do you do with that?
So they had surveillance drone or drones that had memory in it and that could take videos, and also information about the GPS information, geospatial information, that can allow us to pinpoint where this drone was flown, at what date, and what type of video it contains. And this can serve directly as an evidence, because sometimes they were recording the crime, such as the beheadings or some other crime that they were committing. So this can prove us with the exact location and the timestamp what really occurred, when, and how.
So Maybe just, you know, for listeners to understand in a very practical way, you have all this like vast amount of data, and some of it might contain some information on crimes that has been committed by Daesh, and others might basically be irrelevant. So what do you do, first of all? Who is making the decision on what data is being put forward for possible or potential future accountability processes, and what kind of data is basically being erased, or what is actually happening with the data that you perhaps as archivist or someone else deems unnecessary for criminal accountability?
That's an excellent question, and maybe one of the biggest challenges that we faced. When you have, as I said, millions and millions of files, it's extremely labor-intensive and time-consuming to go through each and every piece of information that you have in the system. This is why in 2020, we partnered with Microsoft and the International Computing Center from the United Nations to bring AI services that allows us to pre-process and pre-qualify the information that we have. Using computer vision, we are able to review images and identify if it has graphic content, if it has any landmark, if it has any faces. We could do facial recognition and then facial matching against the database. But also using natural language processing, we were able to extract the audio track from videos, put it into text, and translate it from Arabic to English. This allowed us to really categorize and organize the information that allows then the investigator, instead of going through the entire corpus of data, to search using key terms and keywords, and that identify whether it's a video, it's a text file, or it's images. A concrete example is for the investigation on crime committed against the Yazidi. They were able to search through key search terms such as Yazidi or Sinjar or Kojo, or a specific date or locations, and then all information responding to those search criteria would pop up. It was practically impossible for the team of 200 people through a year or two to go through tens of millions of documents and making sure that we categorize all of them. So once we do this enrichment, adding tags to the different files, then we had what we call e-discovery review teams who will search based on criteria provided by the investigators, name of a suspect, specific location, specific type of crimes, specific type of material, because a lot of documents coming from ISIS was from the different ministries of ISIS, Ministry for Education, Islamic Police, Oil, and so on. So if they were interested in a specific area of ISIS activities, they could search through the search terms. When you have hundreds and hundreds of thousands of hits, then it goes to an e-discovery review team who are going to go through the document and do exactly what you just described. Sees what are those files or those documents that are relevant for investigation and those that are not.
So this sounds like a very, very complicated and complex process. And I find this absolutely fascinating. And especially, it seems to me how AI and humans work together in order to make this decision on what is actually worth being preserved. So my question would be, and then I think we need to move on to a little bit more the bigger picture again. My question would be, how did you verify that the material that you had wasn't fake or planted for specific purposes, misleading? But also, who gave the input for the keywords for the algorithm to find this information and do the matching exercises? Because AI needs data, you know, it needs to be fed. And this is still a human process at the start.
Absolutely. And the decision was made by human. The computer will help the human make decision in a more effective way by limiting the amount of information they have to go through to make a decision. In terms of the verifying the authenticity and the relevance and integrity of the data, this was at the core of our processes. Since we arrived, what we did was not just take whatever the source was giving us as XML drive or so on. It was to go back to the original devices that was seized by the coalition forces. From there, we have a team of forensic experts who will take a pure and perfect copy of that devices. And then we will make a second copy that will be used for our work. because this would allow us to maintain a chain of custody and to be able to go back to the original evidence. As you said, if you modify a file, the metadata of the file will change. And we identified on some of the initial information that we had that the date of last modification was not back to 2014 or 15, but more recently. So as part of ensuring that we go to the most reliable source, then we will go back whenever possible to the initial drive that was collected directly from the ground.
And after all this work that you have done and all these different actors involved in it as well, what has happened now with all what you have done? And have you built an archive as such? Would you describe the end product as an archive? And also, how is it used now?
That's one of the, I think you've been aware of the different controversies or discussion that came around. The purpose, when the TOR for this investigative team was defined, it was left to the Iraqi government and the UN to decide what would be the future of the work of the UNITEL. It is important to know that, you know, throughout our 6 years of activity in Baghdad, we supported more than 300 requests from assistance from third state. We've managed to provide information that was relevant and led to the conviction of 15 suspects that has been convicted for crimes, international crime or terrorism. And now what is happening with this archive? As you may have read online, all the data, all the information that has been collected in Iraq has been moved to New York, and he is with the Office of Archive and Record Management section in New York. It's live, it's available there. Now there is no framework. There has been there is no way forward for now to use this archive the way it was used when the team was in place. Because when the team was set up in Baghdad, we have a mandate, we have a mission, and we have the authority to use that information to support prosecutions around the globe. Now, the Office of Legal Affairs in New York, as well as the Iraqi government and Security Council, may determine on a case-by-case basis the use of this information. But what is important is that, yes, it's an archive. Yes, it is live and available in New York. Now, the way it's going to be used is still to be determined.
But are you saying that everyone potentially could use that archive for any sort of purposes? Let's say if I'm a victim of Daesh and I want to see what happened or how my own fate is described in the archive or the records or what happened to my family, would that be possible if I would like to engage in a memorization effort? Could I use the archive?
As of today, an individual cannot access that information. However, the Office of Legal Affairs is receiving a request from third state, and I believe they are still discussing on how they could use this archive to fulfill those requests for information. But there is no clear plan forward on how it is going to be used. As of today, you can say that it's a cold archive because there is no mandate to use it and to continue serving the purpose.
What do you think will be the future for the UN in terms of using AI and archiving going forward, let's say in 10, 20 years? Where do you see the UN and archives there?
So, yes, it has been part of the archiving and records management has been part of the work of the UN since its inception. Now, what we saw, and whether it's with the UNITAD team or the other mechanisms in Geneva, IIMM or IIIMM, is that more and more data are naturally digitally born. And the volume of data is, you know, exponential compared to what we were, you know, dealing with before. So now there is a need, and this is what the UN has done, to build capacity in order to be able to leverage this huge amount of data. We've deployed the proper tool, we've trained the internal resources. What we realized as well when we were in Baghdad, when we arrived 4 or 5 years after the facts, is that it's very difficult to have a chain of custody that starts from the time of collection to the where we are. So, and we made a lot of efforts in training civil society organizations because they are the first responders. They are the ones who are on the ground. They are the ones who are taking the first testimonies. They are the ones who collected some of the information. So I think the key is to enable them to do that according to international standards, whether it's interview, whether it's a collection and documentation of the crime. We have to facilitate that and give them means to do it in a way that can be easily used by the UN and other accountability mechanisms. I think when we look at what is happening in Sudan, what is happening in Ukraine and Gaza, they are the one on the ground, the victims, the community of victims, the society organization, to really document and see what is happening. So it's essential that we give them the proper tool and proper technology, maybe an app or some website that allows them to capture the information in a forensically sound manner and easily accessible to accountability mechanism. So I think this could be the future. But the UN has done a lot of work and investment in order to catch up in terms of technology and technological solutions to manage their archive and their evidence.
Thank you very much, Babacar, for sharing your insights into the work of the United Nations in Iraq in terms of investigating and collecting data on the Daesh crimes. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.